Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are on a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's conference. At that time, to ask a question, please press star one on your touch-tone phone and record your name at the prompt. This call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. And I would now like to turn the call over to Mr. J.D. Harrington. Sir, you may begin at your readiness.
Thank you, Susan. Hello, I'm J.D. Harrington, Public Affairs Officer for NASA's Science Mission Directorate in Washington, D.C. I'd like to welcome you to today's media teleconference, where we will discuss the status of Kepler Space Telescope, one of our premier space telescopes. Before we begin, a few items to discuss. We have three panelists joining us today. Each will give a short 2 to 4 minute briefing, and then we'll move to question and answers. Accepting questions from media that dialed into the telephone bridge here, as well as those that submitted questions via Twitter using the hashtag AskNASA. This media telecon will be limited to 1 hour. Today's panelists include Paul Hertz, NASA's Astrophysics Division Director, headquarters in Washington, D.C. Charles Sobeck, the Deputy Project Manager at the Ames Research Center in California, as well as William Borucki, Kepler's Principal Investigator, also at Ames. And with that, we'll get started. Paul?
Thank you, J.D. The Kepler mission launched from the Cape Canaveral Air Force Station on March 6, 2009. In November 2012, Kepler completed its prime mission and entered extended mission. Its prime mission was to search for the signals of rocky planets orbiting in the habitable zones of other stars. Kepler was fully successful in collecting the data that was planned for its mission, and analysis of that data is ongoing. Many exciting exoplanet results have already been reported, and I'm confident that the full analysis data will confirm my belief that the best is yet to come. We reported last May that a second reaction wheel on Kepler had failed, and this was following the failure of a first reaction wheel in July of 2012. At that time, we said that due diligence and additional engineering tests were required before we would know whether or not Kepler could resume its original mission, which requires three working reaction wheels. During the past 3 months, the Kepler team has spent hundreds of hours analyzing data and developing various strategies to try to bring these wheels back online. Those engineering tests have been completed, and Charlie Sobeck is here to answer any questions you have about those tests. Today, we are reporting that we do not believe that we can recover three-wheel operations or Kepler's original science mission. So, the Kepler project is turning its attention to studying the possibility of two-wheel operations. We have two parallel studies underway. The first is an engineering study to determine what kind of two-wheel operations are possible and what it would take in order to implement such operations, two-wheel operations, and what kind of observatory capabilities we might expect with two-wheel operations. The second parallel study is a science study to assess what kind of science might be done with the capabilities of a two-wheel Kepler observatory and whether that science is compelling enough to justify continued investment in Kepler operations. Both studies are due in the fall. After NASA receives the studies, after NASA headquarters receives the studies, we will assess the costs and benefits of two-wheel Kepler operations. In this era of constrained resources for continued operations of any of our missions that have already completed their prime phases, NASA may use a senior review to help us prioritize a two-wheel Kepler mission against the continued operations of other NASA astrophysics missions. Only after weighing these considerations will NASA be in a position to make a decision on the future of Kepler operations. I want to explicitly recognize the effort, the extraordinary effort by the Kepler project to try and recover Kepler's three-wheel operations. I believe they've left no stone unturned in their due diligence studies. However, we are now moving on to the next phase of Kepler's mission because that's what the data requires us to do. This is not the last you'll hear of Kepler. There's a huge amount of data collected that we'll continue to analyze. The science and principal investigator, Bill Borucki, is here to make some comments about the science yet to be done with the Kepler data set. In addition, we will be hosting the second Kepler Science Conference this November. I'm confident that Kepler's most exciting science results are yet to be announced. With the conclusion of those remarks, let me pass it over to Charlie Sobeck, the Deputy Project Manager for the Kepler Project.
Thanks, Paul. As Paul mentioned, we've been doing due diligence to investigate the opportunity to recover the damaged compromised wheels. In July, we ran some tests to verify the functionality of those wheels, and we were delighted to find that the wheels, in fact, would spin upon command, that both wheels would, in fact, spin in both directions. And the next stage of our restoration program was to see now whether or not the wheels could spin sufficiently well to control the pointing of the vehicle, of the spacecraft. We did that last week in a test where we reinserted the compromised wheel number 2 along with the good wheels numbers 1 and 3 and tried to control the spacecraft with those three wheels. Initially, we went to a benign standby mode, and for 2 hours, we stayed in that mode and monitored the attitude of the spacecraft, and it performed quite well, perhaps only marginal in terms of being able to get to our precision fine point operations, but still within a 10 arc second error of where we wanted to be. That's really a very small error in pointing. We then turned the spacecraft to Earth, turned the antenna to Earth, and we downloaded the data that's been stored on our onboard recorder for the last 3 months. We got all that data down. During that period, we did see an increase in friction in the wheel number 2. Our motors on that wheel did enable us to compensate for that increase in friction for about another 4 hours, enough time for us to finish that data downlink. After that, the friction went beyond what we could accommodate, and the error in pointing increased beyond the degree limit that we had set on it, and the spacecraft autonomously went into its safe mode of operations. We've since recovered the spacecraft from safe mode back to its point rest state, where we use thrusters in a very fuel-efficient manner to control the spacecraft, keep it power positive, keep the communications link open. But the results of that show what we expected to see, which is that the wheels are sufficiently damaged that they cannot sustain spacecraft pointing control for any extended period of time. So given that history, we are moving forward to look at what we can do without those wheels. So with the 2 good wheels and the thrusters available to us, as Paul said, we're going to see what kind of science we can do with that. And with that, I'm going to hand it over to Bill to talk about what we've accomplished to date in the science arena.
Thank you, Charlie. The Kepler mission has been spectacularly successful. At the beginning of the mission, no one knew whether Earth-sized planets were abundant or rare in our galaxy. Now, at the completion of the Kepler observations, we know that our galaxy is filled to the brim with planets. It's likely that when you look up at the sky at night and see the sky covered with stars, most of the stars have planets. And a large fraction of these planets are small, like the Earth, not giants, not gas giants like Saturn and Jupiter. However, only a few of the Earth-sized planets found so far are at the right distance from their star so that liquid water could exist on their surface. They orbit between sort of the fire line and the ice line, not so far from the star that the oceans are frozen, not so close to the star that the oceans boil. It's sort of the Goldilocks zone where water could be liquid and there's a possibility of life. However, only a few of the Earth-sized planets found so far are at the right... These planets, however, differ from the Earth orbiting our Sun, in that they orbit stars generally that are smaller and cooler than our Sun, and many of these planets are substantially larger than our Earth. To a large degree, the results that we have found so far are based on the 3,500 planetary candidates, including several hundred Earth-sized candidates that Kepler has found. And they found developed these results from just the first 2 years of data. As we dig into all the data that's been accumulated during the four full years of operation, we expect hundreds, maybe thousands, of new planet discoveries, including the long-awaited Earth-sized planet orbiting a star as hot as our sun, so a very sun-like star. The total accumulated data that we have now should provide the necessary number of transits required to detect small planets in the habitable zone. Orbital periods are like that of the Earth, 365 days. We need three or four transits to get enough signal to find these small planets. And that means we need 3 or 4 years of data. We now have that data. And so we really expect, as Paul was saying, the most exciting discoveries are going to come in the next few years as we search through all this data. Another aspect of that is that as we go on, we continue to improve the data analysis pipeline. And that's really important because it reduces the data, the variability of the stars, and allows us to find the small planets in the long period orbits. And so basically, in the next few years, when we complete this analysis, we'll be able to answer the questions that inspired the Kepler mission. Are Earths common or rare in our galaxy? Thank you. And now I'd like to turn it back to J.D.
Thanks, Bill. And with that, we'll start the question and answer session. Just for information, we have 38 reporters on the telephone bridge today. As such, we're going to limit everyone to one question with one follow-up. Once everyone has had a chance to ask a question, and if time permits, we'll start from the beginning again. I ask that you would identify yourself, your media affiliation, and then direct your question to a specific panelist if possible to eliminate any confusion. Once again, for those dialing in, push the star 1 keys on your telephone to be placed in the queue. And if you're using Twitter, send your questions to hashtag AskNASA. And with that, we'll begin. Susan?
Thank you. Our first question is from Irene Klotz from Reuters. Your line is open.
Thanks very much. I wanted to ask probably Charlie or maybe Paul, what is the currently planned operations budget for Kepler? And I also have a question for you, Bill.
I'll answer that one, and Charlie can correct me if I'm remembering wrong, but I believe that Kepler is budgeted for approximately $18 million in FY13.
Charlie?
That's approximately right. It's something in that area.
Any follow-up, Irene?
I apologize. I lost her line. If she can hit star one again really quick.
So she can go on to the next one, and if she dials in, we'll give her priority. Oh, there she is.
Okay, one moment. Go ahead, Irene. Your line is open, please.
Okay, thanks very much. The other question is science-related. I understand that without the three-wheel positioning, you couldn't do the same sort of transit surveys that Kepler's been doing, but are its extrasolar planet hunting days over? Are you looking at completely different missions, or are there some of these previous studies that still could be done with a two-wheel and thruster combinations? Thanks.
The missions there that have been suggested to us are of quite a large variety, looking for asteroids, looking for a comet, looking for a supernova, and the possibility of doing something called microlensing, where we look at stars in our own galaxy, and these might show us giant planets, the Jupiters and Saturns, in long period orbits. So there's several different possible missions. Until we have analyzed the full capability of the mission and we have looked at what the requirements are in terms of guidance, we really have no way of knowing which of these missions would be practical.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question is from Marcia Dunn with the Associated Press. Your line is open.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, Dr. Baruchy. I'm wondering if you feel two questions. The first is whether you feel some sadness related to the inability to go back to normal operations and what might have been found had it continued on normal operations? And my second question is, of these 135 confirmed exoplanets, how many of those might be considered Earth-size in the habitable zone?
Okay, well, certainly the first one, I really feel immense satisfaction with what the mission has accomplished. It really has been spectacular. We now have Earth-sized planets, planets smaller than Earth-size. We have planets twice the size, five times, just enormous around all sorts of stars. So I'm absolutely delighted with what we have accomplished. It reminds me a little bit of, you know, when we started the mission, we conceived the mission. It was sort of like I was standing out in this desert, and it was empty. There was no knowledge of other planets. Now I feel sort of like I'm standing at the bottom of the ocean, and I'm just covered with an ocean full of data on all these possible planets. So I'm really delighted with what we have found. It would have been even better if we could have lengthened the mission, because we would have found better statistics on these small planets in long period orbits. We have explored stars hotter than the sun, and we won't be able to do as much of that as I think we'd all like. So there's a little bit of regret, but basically I'm very satisfied. 135 planets we have confirmed. We've certainly confirmed some planets that are essentially Earth-sized. Those have been sort of at the extreme of the habitable zone. We've confirmed some planets that are a little bit bigger than the Earth, about 1.4 times the size of the Earth. Those are in the habitable zone. Now, those are, in fact, with stars that are a little bit smaller than the sun, about 70% the size of the sun, but only about 20% the emission, the brightness of the flux from the sun. So we have a few, but what we're really looking for is a planet that's really Earth-sized, and not around a star cooler than the sun, but a star just like the sun. And so that's what we're hunting for, and that's what we're really hoping for will be in this data, these last 2 years of data that we have yet to fully analyze.
Thank you. Our next question is from Dennis Overby with the New York Times. Sir, your line is open.
I think Marcia just covered my questions.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. Alan Boyle with NBC News. Your line is next. One moment. Go ahead, sir. Your line is
all
open.
Right. Very good. I guess this would be for Bill. What do you expect the schedule for working on that that data that really has the key things that you're looking for would be? I know there had been talk about how, well, you really need three years of data to find an Earth-sized planet in an Earth-like orbit around a sun-like star, and you probably feel you have that. Sounds like the statistics are not so good, not as good as you would like. But how much analysis does that take, and do you expect that there will be an endpoint for Kepler data analysis and kind of closing the book on this?
We've looked at what we need to do to truly use that data that we have and come up with a good answer, a definitive answer, for the frequency of various sized planets around various stars, in particular an estimate of what we call Atus of Earth, the frequency of Earth, Earth-sized planets in the habitable zone of stars, very much like the sun. We're not going to get lots and lots of such planets, so what we need to do is look carefully at all the planets in that data. And so we expect that it's going to take about 2 years, probably, to go through all that data, to improve that pipeline, to build that catalog, to then take into account all the bias factors that exist. You know, we only see planets that transit, but we know there are lots of other planets. So we have to compensate for all these different bias factors to give us a definitive answer of how frequent Earths are. And so my belief is that that will occur in about 3 years. About 3 years, I would expect we'll have that number.
Okay, and if I could have a follow-up just on another aspect, maybe Charlie could talk about whether when you were able to get the wheels moving, did you really feel that you could bring this spacecraft fully back, or what was the up and down feeling that you had as you worked with this?
I think that all of us who were investigating the wheels at that point really had very little hope that we would be able to recover the wheels. NASA as an agency has not experienced with wheels being recovered once they had gotten to this level of degradation, this level of friction. The data we saw showed that, for example, wheel four was not moving initially in one of the directions, but when we reversed it, it did move. And I kind of liken that to a pushing a shopping cart at a supermarket where one wheel sticks. The first thing I do is sort of pull it backwards, and often you can unstick it, but, you know, in the next four or five steps you take, it's likely to stick again, and that's what we expected to see happen. And I think that's what did happen. So as Paul said, we were doing what we thought was due diligence. We could have been surprised. We didn't want to leave these wheels untested, but we had very little hope that it was actually going to be recoverable.
Thank you.
Thank you. And our next question is from Adam Becker with the New Scientist magazine. Sir, your line is open.
My question's actually already been covered.
Okay, thank you. Our next question then is from Elizabeth Howell of Universe Today. Your line is open.
Hello, this could be for anybody. I was curious as to what sort of other components on the spacecraft might be in danger of degrading while you have it parked up there and you're deciding what to do with it next. Thank you.
This is Charlie Sobeck. We've looked at what the other components of the spacecraft are, and certainly we're in a radiation environment where anything could get hit by a cosmic ray. Things are aging. But the spacecraft, aside from the wheels, has been doing great. It's really still working very, very well. The instrument that we have had a module fail on us during the first year of operations, but since then, the instrument has performed great. So while something might fail, there's nothing on the horizon that looks like it's marginally degrading and is likely to fail shortly. The biggest concern we would have is the use of our fuel, which is a limited life expendable. If we use it all up, then we don't have any left. So we're being very careful in how we use our fuel.
And as a follow-up, how long do you think the fuel could last in the state you have it now? I assume you have it in point rest state right now?
We have it in point rest state. I think we are talking in terms of years. How many years? I don't know. In fact, I believe that we're going to learn that tomorrow as we hear from the engineers here at Ball Aerospace that have been working on this, what the latest prediction is. But I think we're talking several years.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Our next question is from Matt Smith of CNN. Your line is open.
Yes, hi there. Sorry if I missed this earlier, but when was the determination made that you could no longer maintain three-wheel control?
So again, this is Charlie Sobeck. We ran this test that determined that the wheels would not be able to hold control starting a week ago today, so last week on Thursday. The test ran overnight, and the wheel failed late Thursday evening Pacific time. It was following that test that determination was made, so it's been in the last week.
Okay, thank you.
And again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1. Our next question is from Alan Boyle with NBC News.
Sorry, just a quick follow-up for Bill. You mentioned that it would take 2 years to really sift through the data and then take 3 years to compensate for all the bias factors. Is that 2 plus 3 or really 3 years to finish up the data analysis work?
No, that's the total. 3 years would be the total.
Yep.
The first 2 years basically are running the data through computers and improving the analysis pipeline to find those really small planets. So the total would be 3 years.
Thank you.
Thank you. And our next question is from Al Spaller with KVMR-FM. Your line is open, sir.
Thank you. Why is it, if I understood correctly, that the only small, nearly Earth-sized planets are found around red dwarfs or stars smaller than the Sun?
That's a very good question. It's Bill Borucki. The habitable zone, which is the zone where we could have liquid water, is very close to cool small stars. So if you say you need three or four transits, well, you get those in a couple of years, and that's what we have done. Well, you see that we have found generally small planets or the planets in the habitable zone around these small, cool stars. But as you get to stars much more like the Sun, they have to have orbital periods like that of the Earth, about 365 days. So if you want to find three or four transits, you need to look for 3 or 4 years, and so that's what we've done. We now have about 4 years of data, and so that's why we're saying, as we analyze this total accumulation of data, this is the time that we'll start finding those planets.
This is J.D. I've got a Twitter question from the Ask NASA group, and this would probably either go to Bill or Paul. Would the micro-lensing option for Kepler not be a good precursor for WFIRST with the additional coronagraph and thus help those efforts?
Well, I don't know about programmatic matters, and Paul should address that. But clearly, anytime we have an opportunity to explore our galaxy and find planets, we should take it. And this in particular case, if we can find that the mission can produce the science and can produce it for a reasonable cost, then it ought to be considered.
And I'll just comment, this is Paul Hertz at NASA headquarters. I'll comment from the programmatic point of view that, of course, microlensing surveys have been underway for quite a few years using ground-based telescopes, which is how the microlensing technique, which detects planets around other stars by seeing the effect they make on the light of a more distant star when they pass in front of it, have been underway from Earth. By going to space to do microlensing, you can detect smaller planets, which is one of the things that either a Kepler microlensing experiment, if it's possible, would be able to do, and certainly the WFIRST microlensing experiment, which is part of the WFIRST mission, would be able to do. So, you know, if that data can be collected with Kepler, it'd be interesting for us to consider how valuable that would be as a bridge between the existing microlensing surveys from ground-based telescopes to the future microlensing survey with WFIRST.
The other thing that you can do with the data Kepler might be able to provide is, because it's at quite a different angle from the Sun than the Earth, then when you the ground-based people find a microlensing event, we have a different view of it, a different phase. And that phase will, at least sometimes, give you much more information than you get with a single station. You can get a much better estimate, in particular, of the mass of the lensing star, the star that's nearby that may or may not have the planets. And if you know more about the mass, you can tell more about how far the planets are and how massive they are. So it provides a really important auxiliary measurement to the ground-based measurements that we're currently doing.
Thank you. Our next question is from Mike Wall of space.com. Sir, your line is open.
Okay, yeah, thanks, guys, for all doing this. This is probably for Charlie. So it sounds like I just wanted to actually confirm. I mean, the original planet hunting mission is now pretty much done, but, I mean, you guys saying that it's possible that you still could actually detect planets, maybe just in a different way. I just wanted to sort of get a better handle on whether Kepler could actually still be used to find new planets.
Yeah, I'll defer the actual question about finding planets to Bill, but let me say that what we're saying is done today is our precision-pointed mission. We're not going to be able to point the spacecraft at the milli-arc-second level that we've grown accustomed to with good reaction wheels. Our pointing will be less than that. We don't know yet how much less it will be and less good it will be. But the question then becomes, yeah, your pointing may not be as good as you used to have, but it's still a pretty good point. What science can you do? Can you do some planet search? And I'll ask Bill to answer what we might be able to do.
We really need to understand what the spacecraft can do. This is an idea that's been broached by various people that we should consider. We have to really ask ourselves, how well can we point to make that measurement? And, you know, the microlensing events occur over a fairly short period of time when we're talking about a planet transit. and we don't know about them that much earlier. So if you say, I need to point the telescope to some part of the sky, and I only know about it, you know, 24 hours ahead of time, we don't communicate with a spacecraft that frequently. DSN time is valuable. So it's not, we're really unsure as to what's practical here. We're going to consider these ideas carefully. We're going to find out which ones are practical, and we're going to try to cost what it would do to, for each of these missions. But at the present time, we really do not know whether any of these concepts are practical.
Thank you.
Thank you. And our next question is from Jason Rehan with AmericaSpace.com. Your line is open, sir.
Jason Rehan with AmericaSpace.com. I have a quick question. Really, with the, it looks like the end of Kepler here, has there even been any thought as to what a follow-on mission might be? And if so, could you maybe give us a little bit of details on that?
It is not the end of the Kepler mission. That is a terrible misstatement. The mission, it composed of two things. You make the observations, you analyze the observations. The mission's done when you finish your analysis, you have a result. We have all this data that we have not yet analyzed, and we expect many, many more discoveries, particularly interesting discoveries. So the Kepler mission is in no way done at this point.
Okay. Okay, and you asked, this is Paul Hertz at NASA headquarters. You asked about potential follow-on missions to Kepler. Well, we've already identified a follow-on mission to Kepler. It's the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, TESS, which will be our next explorer mission. It's in development now, and will launch in the 2017-2018 timeframe. And it will be doing a transit survey very similar to Kepler's transit survey, but it will be surveying the brightest and closest stars in the entire sky, and we'll be finding transiting exoplanets that are close to Earth, and therefore ripe for follow-up by satellites like the Hubble Space Telescope or the James Webb Space Telescope.
Okay, I have a follow-up then. First of all, let me apologize for my misspeaking. Was it like always planned that the follow-on mission, was it always planned to take place after Kepler, or was it developed as we saw what was coming out of the Kepler Space Telescope, where there's kind of a symbiotic relationship there?
So this is Paul Hertz at headquarters. I'll take that one. So I don't want to speak for the principal investigator of the TESS mission, and that was really the kind of question to ask him of how it was conceived of. The idea of looking for transiting exoplanets that are closer to the Earth than the ones that Kepler typically finds is an obvious next step after the kind of science that Kepler did. And George Ricker of MIT, who's the principal investigator of TESS, did submit a proposal for a mission to do exactly like that, and that is the mission TESS that NASA has selected. So it is a follow-on to the science of Kepler, it is the exciting science of Kepler that makes it so obvious that TESS will also be an exciting scientific mission.
And, of course, there will be a follow-up to TESS as well, because certainly as we take these steps in exploring our galaxy, we're really looking forward to not only finding planets around the nearest stars, but finding out more about their atmospheres. What's the composition of those atmospheres? And future missions will look at those questions as well and answer those questions.
And of course, the first mission, the next mission that'll do that, you know, the Hubble Space Telescope and the Spitzer Space Telescope are already looking at the atmospheres of some exoplanets, and the James Webb Space Telescope will be able to do an even better job of that when it's launched in 2018.
Thanks, Paul. Another Twitter question here. This one probably goes to Charlie. If we are able to find the capability of doing two-wheel and thruster science, how long will Kepler last if we're using thruster fuel?
In a nutshell, I think it is likely to last quite a while. Thrusters are mainly used to overcome the solar pressure that we see, and whether you overcome the solar pressure in one mode or another mode, it doesn't change the fuel usage very much. So unless we decide that there's something really important that we want to spend a lot of fuel on, we're likely talking about operating in that kind of a mode again for several years.
And thank you again. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone phone and pronounce your name and your affiliation. Our next question is from Adam Becker with New Scientist magazine. Sir, your line is open.
Hi. I guess this is really a question for anyone. When are we going to see the proposals that have been submitted for what to do with Kepler?
Basically, what we have done is ask the science community for their ideas. That is, we've asked them for white papers. Those white papers are due in a few weeks. And then we will look at these ideas. They're not proposals. They're not asking for funds. They're suggesting ideas. And we look at which of these would be practical. Which of these could we do for a reasonable cost? And then those things form the basis of what we would suggest a true headquarters for their consideration. And Paul has already talked to that question about how that would be considered at headquarters, basically in competition with other missions that are now flying.
Okay, then a follow-up then. Going beyond exoplanets, somebody else asked about WFIRST, and you mentioned supernovae, and I know WFIRST is meant to look at supernovae as well. Does the Kepler scope have the infrared and spectroscopic capabilities that would allow it to do some of the more detailed supernova monitoring that WFIRST is designed to do?
Not at all. Basically, what we can do, and I believe we have seen some supernova, in fact, in our data, it's entirely a visible system, and so it doesn't compete with WFIRST in any way, but it can contribute some additional information to the science.
Great. Okay, thank you.
Once again, this is J.D. If you'd like to ask a question of the Kepler team, you don't get this option very often, but the lines are open. We'll wait a moment, and if we don't, we'll close this out. Stand by. All right, Susan, you can go with our next reporter.
Our next question is from Mark Zastro of Science Health. Sir, your line is open.
Thank you. This question is for Bill, I think. Bill, you said that you're pretty confident that with the data that you have, the team should be able to recover an Earth-like planet around a Sun-like star. And I guess I'm just wondering, is that prognosis an upgrade from where you might have expected it a few months ago or even a year ago? And has the data pipeline improved to enable that?
At the beginning of the mission, of course, we had to propose what we would expect to find as a result. And we felt that if we had 4 years of data, that we would have enough data to find these small planets. What surprised us, I think, is the fact that there seems to be a lot of, stellar variability and other kinds of noise that have meant that we're on schedule. But the noise is a little bit more than we expected. In particular, stars like the Sun seem to be somewhat more variable than expected. So we're going to have to dig down hard to find these small planets. But we've already found planets that are much smaller than the Earth, smaller than Mars. We found planets as small as the Moon. So we know we can do it, but what we need to do it is with the long orbital periods, where we only have 3 or 4 transits, and where we have it around fairly noisy stars. And so that's where we get a big payoff in continuing to improve the pipeline. So I'm confident that we are going to find what we expected, that we're going to have sufficient statistics, but we're going to have to work hard for the next couple of years.
Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question is from Roseanne Skirbel with Voice of America. Your line is open.
you very much. It's been really an interesting conference. I just would like a summary statement, if each of you could just say something about how you feel about the mission and your anticipation. I know you've said some of that already before, but if you could express, you know, why this is so important, why this mission is so important, and the mission to the analysis.
The mission is important. It's critically important to mankind's future. We are looking at the idea of exploring our galaxy one step at a time. We have found that there are planets in our galaxy. There are many planets. There are Earth-sized planets. And now we're looking forward to tests which will tell us about planets around nearby stars. And then we're looking forward to the next mission which will tell us about the composition of the atmospheres. And so this is a step, one step among many, but it's a crucial step. If we had found there were very few Earths, our exploration of the galaxy might be very, very different. We might not choose to explore it. So it's a critical step in mankind's understanding of its place in the galaxy and what life might be out there.
Does anyone else? That was beautiful. Anyone else want to take a...
Look, can't compete with Bill.
Okay, we got an open mic here. Give you one more chance, then we'll close out if necessary. Stand by.
The print.
Okay, well, I think then we're going to close out the today's Kepler News telecon. I'd like to thank our panelists and our operator, Susan, for their time. If you'd like more information about Kepler, you know you can always go on the web at www.nasa.gov/Kepler. And for more information about NASA or any of its other missions, go to the web, www.nasa.gov. You can also go to many of our social media venues, such as Facebook, Google+, Twitter, YouTube. There are many others, so you can find out about NASA if you choose to. Once again, thanks for joining us, and have a great day.
Thank you for participating in today's conference. That does conclude this call. Please disconnect your lines. Speakers, stand by for post-conference.